Honorable members, can you take our seats? Let me welcome all of you and express my sincere appreciation for the fact that we all seem to appreciate that time is not with us, and therefore we have to work an extra mile or walk an extra mile for us to get the task at hand to be completed. Yesterday we adjourned our meeting with a clear understanding that we'll meet this morning, 8:30. We are 15 minutes late, but I know that some of us have been around this parliament from 7 o'clock, just trying to make sure that the paperwork is processed. And the understanding was that insofar as the fiscal framework is concerned, we would try to make sure that by the end of business yesterday, submissions are forwarded to the Secretariat so that they can be able to, over and above the amendments, to incorporate new proposals. I think we have a product before us, and this product does indicate that indeed we are all trying to move in one direction. As you know, it's Friday, and our wish from the head table here is that both committees should at least by lunch conclude their business. If we can, without much ado, get into the report itself, draft report, and if there are any additions or subtractions, let's do so quickly, and accept our own product. We were more on recommendations. The area of contestation yesterday was around the committee's observations. And I went back to check, honorable members, how did we craft our report last time on the fiscal framework. It is exactly the same structure. There's absolutely nothing new in terms of how we've crafted this report. The other thing that I need to indicate is that the actual detail of the responses of the committee and whatever we wish to say is normally captured in the full report when we deal with the MTBPS. Yes. It's not just in the fiscal framework. The fiscal framework is one but a single chapter of many other chapters of the medium-term budget policy statement. Can we go page by page and see if we've been able to capture the amendments that were actually proposed yesterday? Page one. Last year, honorable, you know, you and I have been talking about reintroducing the floor clause in the legislation and see between the two of us who would move first. And I'm very certain. that there are more prospects on the other side for you. Blessed it here? Moi. Moisio. Honorable Lee, the senior deep and redacted. Batana.
Kylo, I'm going to go to school with you, Luna.
Yeah, no. I can see you are an all rounder. Yeah, you are an all rounder. Blessed three. Honorable Lee.
Chairman, without appearing to be pedantic, may I change a few words? I don't think it's going to be contentious at all. In the first bullet point on the third to last line, compared to European countries, should be compared with. Are we on page three or four?
We're page three.
My apologies.
But I think.
I was looking at section three.
Okay.
Sure.
No. I think what you're basically saying is that on page three, there's nothing to amend. We should move to page four and accept your proposal. Page four? You can make your point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That too should be with. And then may I introduce the word the projected GDP growth is lower in the second bullet point, and then the government debt is set, replace the word set projected again there, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That you say bullet point number two.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, put the word projected between the GDP, between the and GDP. The projected GDP growth is lower than with the forecast or some kind of to make it. It's not. I think it was the Honourable Swart who made the point yesterday that we can't really prophesy exactly what's going to happen. So.
Well, English is not my first language, but when I read this, it says the GDP growth is lower than the 2011 national budget forecast. Forecast is projections. Agree?
Jim, that's fine. If we're referring to the history, so the GDP growth that we've experienced to date,
yeah.
Yes, then it's fine. That's all. But it doesn't really read like that, but that's fine. I'm happy to.
Any other on page three? Honorable Swart, please, I'm not qualified. Please, Swart.
Thank you, Chair. That bullet it says it is thus expected to be 3.1%. So it is projected. It would read better with the word projected there, but it's not the end of the world if you feel that you shouldn't include it in bullet two. But I do think the bullet three, government debt is projected to stabilize. That would be good to insert it there in bullet three in place of the word set. And then the last bullet, English is a strange language. There's nothing wrong to say the state wage bill is growing very fast, but that's anecdotally speaking. In a report, you would use more formal English, such as the state wage bill is rising at an unacceptable rate. But it's continuous. It's rising as well, or has risen, but has risen. Has risen at an unacceptable rate because it's referring to the past, increasing from 31% to 42% in the previous 4-year period. So it's a past tense. If you consider that, Chair. Thank you.
I agree with your proposal that the state wage bill has risen, but just read it again, Steve.
The state wage bill has risen or what I said is an unacceptable rate. Maybe you don't want to use that word, but I want to say very quickly or at a, you see that it's grown very fast. Has risen very rapidly. Then you're not putting a connotation to that. If you say unacceptable, then you're saying that it's too high. You're not accepting that. But if you just say has risen very rapidly, then you're just stating it as a fact that it's risen very rapidly.
Page 5. Honorable Lee?
Just at the bottom, sorry, Chair, just at the bottom, one doesn't want to correct all the grammar, and it's an incredibly well-written report. But just on the bottom of page 4, this is one of the serious concerns for the committee. One, just to phrase it better, is this is a serious concern for the committee.
Yeah. Thanks. Honourable Lee, you on page 5?
Chairman, the first bullet point I would disagree with in the sense that the job creation was incorrectly left for government. I don't think that's true. I think that it's probably true that to say job creation by the state has been greater or better than the private sector. But I don't think the private sector has sort of washed their hands of it and left it, if you understand what I'm trying to say. I accept that the job creation within the state has been greater than the job creation in the private sector. But I don't accept that job creation was incorrectly left for the government, which implies that the private sector has done nothing about it and said, well, it's your problem. That's the way I read it.
Chair, I fully agree with Honourable Lees, because I don't think the intention of the private sector said we don't want to employ. Not at all. In fact, but the reality is that government has been the bigger employer and the fastest growth in employment. So we will have to rephrase that to emphasize that government has been, you know, rose the fastest in terms of employment. But I don't think it was left.
Mama?
My understanding is there wasn't concrete commitment within the business sector. There was very segregational when it came to employment. So the whole load was actually left with the government. It's only now that there is an improvement.
No, but Mr. Chairperson, that's wrong. Private sector respond to stimuluses and to opportunities and to support. Because, I mean, if it was if it was left by them, it was then employment wasn't done, especially because there was no economic growth and there was no competitive edge and there was no incentive for them to employ. And that is what we have identified. And that is the role of fiscal framework, to set the scene so that they can come and employ. I mean, nobody will say, hey, we don't want to employ, so we don't want to grow the economy. That is not the case. That's the wrong understanding of how this works.
I'm not actually now engaging in a dialogue, but I think we're moving at different ways. I didn't say they refused. I said the commitment was very weak at the beginning. It's only afterwards, because of continuous negotiations with the business sector, the rate of people getting retrenched, and we all sit here knowing the truth, raises something.
Honorable Coronel, let's find a...
This is an observation. Now, the observation was not about that it was left for government. I think what was said in the public statement was quite clear, that they are concerned about the slugginess of the labour market. And then he carried on to say that government cannot continue to be the largest employer. That was the point that they were... They were not fingers pointing to the private sector, so I think that's the point that we should make.
Yeah, exactly.
So...
Okay. Do I agree with that sentiment, Honourable Members? And then we'll find a way to capture that. Yeah. Because indeed, if you say it's left, it does create an impression that there's a boycott. All right. We'll find a way to capture the spirit of the statement in the minute, by the minister. We're still on page 5. Any other? Honorable Murray?
Chairperson, this fourth bullet, a shift towards bulk infrastructure would be useful. Again, English is not my first language. But I mean, you know, what does that say? Are we talking about investments? Are we talking, you know, what are we talking about? Utilizing of bulk infrastructure, you know, I don't think that captures the intention of probably, you know, that expenditure or investment must be, I think, to bulk infrastructure.
Help again. I think, you know, if you look at the public statement, it says that the emphasis on the promotion of industrial and economic development and housing and urban infrastructure and employment programs are welcome. That is what they have basically said. That is the shift. The shift in the composition of public expenditure is welcomed, and that the emphasis will be on the promotion of industrial and economic development, on housing, urban infrastructure and employment programs. I think that we can observe that and we can welcome that. But that is exactly what was said.
I tend to agree in terms of the shift in composition of the public expenditure. Let's not use shorthand. We are not journalists. The secretariat. Let's try to capture that will make sense even for people who come beyond us, after us, to understand what the committee was trying to say on this issue. Honorable Swart?
Okay, just to improve language a little bit,
bullet 3,
underspending on infrastructure has been an ongoing problem, and the key challenge, singular, delete the words leading to this problem, delete the word was, put in has been the shortage of relevant skills. So then read, underspending on infrastructure has been an ongoing problem, and the key challenge has been the shortage of relevant skills. Just a slight improvement, Chair. If that's acceptable, then I'd like to just also in the next bullet. The key challenge, singular, has been the shortage of relevant skills.
All right.
And then
the next point?
Not the next bullet, the one following that, given these observations.
Okay.
There is a need for savings and expenditure by all government departments. Now, I don't understand that. Surely an expenditure must come out. Because they will normally expend. There's a need for savings by all government departments. And then the word and must come out and put with a need to focus on the composition of spending. Insert the word that and addressing inefficiency. The committee further expressed its support, not their support, its support. You're referring to the committee. The next,
sorry, is that okay?
No, continue, sir.
The next bullet, there is a further need to ensure that Parliament has an effective oversight over the executive's actions. What does that mean? Over the executive, in order to what? There's no verb there. What? In order to improve operational or ensure. We need a verb there. Is that okay, sir? In order to ensure operational and financial excellence in government departments and their entities. No, excellent, thank you. And then, did we get that? Let's just improve a bit. Sorry, Alan, I don't want to be pedantic. Then the last sentence. Emphasis should ensure, or something along that line, should start by saying that the fiscal framework must be aligned to the new growth plan. Is that better? Thank you.
Part of the training that the Parliament should look into is language proficiency. I'm serious about it. We shouldn't be correcting grammar like this. Should be looking into content. Okay.
Do we agree? Maybe Chair, just that last bullet. The fiscal framework must be aligned to, the new growth path. Includes that concept of other things as well. It's not only the new growth path. So I think somehow we must include a substance. What would you say? Including other issues, including amongst other issues. The fiscal framework must be aligned to the new growth path amongst other objectives.
Okay. Wait and see.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying you should speak. I'm saying, are you noting what I'm saying? Yeah. No. You are not allowed to speak here. I'm just saying no to what you are saying. All right. Anything on page 5? Agreed on page 5? We are now moving to recommendations, page 6. Babalian.
Sentence, the very first one, the, which actually having considered the revised because of the constitution, the committee, not committee, for consistency.
Agreed?
Mr. Chairman, I think that perhaps he's quite right, but it seems to me that the drafter of this has drafted in such a way it's going to become two separate reports. And you see the dots will, in the dotted space, you'll put standing committee and or the select committee. I think that's the way it's drafted. Thank you.
Am I still on the floor, sir?
Yeah, we'll follow the practice. And I think Honorable Lee believes very strongly that the separation of responsibilities should be engendered so that there's no assumption that there's another committee that is assuming another one. I could see that. But that's just a practice. I'm just saying, what does the law say? But let's follow the practice. We did that last time. Honorable Liange?
Yeah, the last one is still in the same sentence. Chair. Now, so it could be the committees of financial recommend, not recommend. Recommend as follows.
No. Honorable Liang, I think what we are saying is that if these reports are going to be adopted separately, it should reflect the committee rather than the committees. Yeah, all right, thanks. Okay, can we move on? Anything on page 6?
Chairperson 5.5, I think we can merge 5.8 with 5.5.
5.5 and 5.?
Yeah, 5.5 and 5.8, I think we can try to merge them just by referring to the 5% limitation. I think that the 5% was stated in the statement of the public. You see, but the point is, the difficulty for the government is going to be to convince the union to take 5% if it's less than inflation. Now, what we should say here is they must come up with other means, but they cannot go beyond the cost of 5% on the state wage bill. And then what we say, if we don't want to say that they must exclude certain categories, let's rather than say they must ensure or attempt to make sure that they do not go beyond the total cost of a 5% increase in their negotiations with all stakeholders.
Can I maybe just add, and that links to also a point that Dr. George and I emailed through, and that means that I think it's an average wage bill of 5%. So an average wage bill of 5% implies that if you give 10% to lower categories, you have to reduce increases of higher categories so that you get your average wage bill, not exceeding 5%. That is the point, I think, and that's why those two points, as well as the recommendation that we made, can be combined and actually speaks to the same thing.
Honourable Lee, Dr. Masile, you'll follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My opinion is that we shouldn't be setting increased limitations. We should be saying your proportion of expenditure on salaries and wages must be reduced. And we shouldn't be tying the hands of the administration by telling them what percentage increase they may or not may not give, because we don't do that in private in enterprise. I've been involved for a long time, and if someone has done an excellent job, then there needs to be a reward for that. And so if you're going to cap everyone at 5%, or even do the average that the Honourable Maria is saying, it kind of limits officials. I believe that we should be saying that it's now at 41%. Get it down to 30% by the end of the medium-term budget framework period. And how it's done is then left up to our officials to do. Rather than us now micromanaging by capping increases.
Sure, I hear what Mr. Lee says, but the issue is in the budget framework, one needs to set out, and the Treasury has already set out the framework over the period of a 5% cost of living adjustment. So we're not coming and saying something new. Page 4, we are, in fact, we are supporting what Treasury has already said. If I might be misunderstanding that, that's something different. But as I understood, Mr. Kernoff's suggestion was that he's bringing his recommendation in line with what Treasury has said on page 4. The proposed framework for the 2012 budget provides for a 5% cost of living adjustment for public sector employees. And then the note next to it says, the budget framework provides for a 5% adjustment for public sector employees. So we are supporting a Treasury's recommendation, I think. It's difficult. Yeah, I would support Mr. Quinoff in that regard in trying to phrase that. But clearly, it's going to be contentious when one can understand that. So it isn't a substantive issue that we need to discuss.
Honourable Masile will be followed by Honourable Mthethwa.
Okay.
Yeah. Same chairperson, I was looking at 5.5 as well. We are really talking to the unions only for this project of getting the wage bill down. And I would have expanded it to go to NEDLAC, because in any way it would have to find its last leg and have a NEDLAC situation for this particular resolution to be taken. And that would be my proposal to expand it to really involve even NEDLAC. Thanks.
Can I?
Okay. Let me allow comrade and honorable Mthethwa, and then be followed by Chani, and then Honorable Goranov will be last.
No, thanks, Chair. I wanted to move with the notion that says, let's not become technical. These matters are issues of administration. For us to take the principles. But even though we support this issue of capping in dealing with the details of the salary, I don't think it would be correct for us to do that. To say it must be kept at 5% irrespective of what. Because there are a number of things that need to be considered when you deal about salary. There are issues of broadbanding that is still there. There are issues of a wage gap that are still there. So coming with just 5% without being informed about these other activities, surely I don't think we'll be doing justice. I support those that are saying, let's not deal with this issue of 5% now and let it our matter. Thank you.
No, Chair, thanks. I think I'm covered by Honourable Mteto and the previous speaker, but the other thing is that this thing of 5% really is not coming up for the first time here now. Even the previous years, Treasury would come and say they've budgeted this much for the public sector, and then agreements will go even beyond that. So our main concern here is that the wage bill, where it is now, need to be closely monitored and controlled. And surely by saying that National Treasury should engage all stakeholders, unions, business, and whoever is involved in this, and come up with a lasting solution, suffice for this committee. But to enter into a scenario of where we also want to express the capping, I don't think we are ready for that, because that will be doing on the basis of that report that Treasury gave, but we don't have full information as to what informs them, except that they are also concerned about the escalating wage bill. With a number of things, the OSDs and all those things that have resulted into that, it was not only the increase. Honourable Tepes summed up it up nicely that let's resist the temptation of wanting to express our views on the case, but rather show our support on the need to get that properly monitored and controlled. Because in all government departments, local government, anywhere department, the wage bill is expected to be at least at 40%. And anything beyond that is discouraged. And even, I think, at national level, that is the same thing. Hence our concern now that it's at 42%. Thank you.
Honourable Corano. Chairperson, I hear what the honourable members are saying, but, you know, this is the one major concern in our economy, the state wage. And if we cannot be bold as a committee to, you know, on this issue, I don't think we're doing our job. So if we don't want to, you know, Treasury sticked out their neck and the unions are attacking them and fighting already with them on the 5% issue. But, you know, if they go beyond 5%, we are in trouble. Now, the point is, let's forget about the 5%. Let's be bold then and say in the next 3 years, it must come down from 42% of GDP to 38% at least, to be under that threshold of 40%. Then we're saying the same thing, but at least we're sending a clear signal what we think about 40% the GDP for the state, for the wage.
Yeah. You want to come back? Maybe I should make my point before. Without closing. Okay. Might as well, and then you'll be followed by the Woha again.
I think I hear the arguments for the cap to be retained in the report, but the truth of the matter is that those negotiations happen at government level, and we don't want a situation where even Parliament now is called in to negotiate with the union. If we put a cap, it will come to that. Certainly they will come here and say, look, you took a resolution, A, B, C, D, and we because of our situation, we want a percentage higher than 5. Purely, it is an administrative matter. That's why we want that cap to be removed. Purely, it's an administrative issue and nothing else. Of course, we would be concerned about the human resource wage bill. Definitely, would be concerned. We'll talk about it. Parliament can't be shy to talk about it if we feel that really things are not going right. But we should not keep it.
Chairperson, can I just say, one must remember part of the fiscal, part of the objective of the fiscal framework is also how to indicate how we will balance the books. So we can't also give a blank check. That implies that we agree that the books will not be balanced. So obviously, you know, I mean, that's a bad sign from us. So in other words, in line with what Treasury said and already acknowledged, that the revenue is down, expected to go down, deficit is going up, so somewhere along the line, we will have to do something to bring everything more in balance. So do not indicate that there is a concern, and we identify that 40%, 42% is much too high. And I know that from local government side, when I was telling the local government, the benchmark was really 33%. So if you talk about 30, you know, it needs to come below 40%. You know, and then you can give 40% increase as well, as long as you stay below that. So in other words, if we grow the economy, nobody needs to earn less, but we need to grow the economy. That's the balance of the scale.
Can I say this, honourable member? You see, I don't think there's anyone amongst us that says the wage bill that has increased from 31% to 42% in the last 4 years is something that we should not be concerned about. I think we're all concerned about. And indeed, we should be concerned about, because the fiscal framework does also indicate that there is very little, or there's a decline in terms of capital expenditure. And we need to reverse that trend. When we speak about a shift in expenditure patterns, amongst others, is to address that challenge. Now, the mechanism, and I think that what the committee should be saying is that we support the initiatives of National Treasury to reduce the wage bill from 42% over a period of time in the MTM period. Whatever measures they are going to take, we support those measures. Because if we lock ourselves into percentages as a committee, that would be problematic. I don't think we should venture into that. But what we want to see over a period of time, particularly within the MTM period, would want to see the wage bill actually declining as a component of the budget. So, and I think we should actually leave it at that level, honourable member. Agreed? Yeah. We're still on page 6. In fact, I think what the Honourable Goranov had proposed, that 5.5 and 5.8. Yeah, okay. Honourable Yenge?
5.3, the National Treasury should expedite infrastructural development through partnership with the private sector. And then the following sentence, it says, these will. So if, for consistent purposes, if it is going to be this, it should be partnership in the previous sentence. If it's going to be a partnership, then this will also require the review to the file. So this and partnership. I don't know what. 5.3. Yeah. If it will be partnership, it will be this. If it's partnership, this. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Liangye. Honorable Mashila, I'm sorry I didn't bring your pen along, but make your contribution.
It's the most expensive pen that I cannot forget, Chair. Actually, I was just wanted to check that 5.3, whether it is correct, and is National Treasury really have that responsibility of expediting infrastructural development? Are we really correct with that? Because my understanding is that they may play a facilitation role, but really, whether it's National Treasury's responsibility when it comes to infrastructural whatever. I just wanted to check the correctness of that specific provision.
Okay, President, yes, thank you. The Deputy Minister made a remark on this point referring to that specific unit that the gentleman was sitting at the back driving this unit on the PPPs. And then we said that we would like to engage with Treasury to come and bring that report to the committee. What are they actually doing? That was part of that discussion.
All right. I see there's another meeting there. And it's a meeting that will make sure that we finalize the recommendation much quicker.
Chairman, there seems to be some confusion because the members are now arriving for a debt collectors meeting.
Okay.
Chair, the Justice Committee was invited to a joint meeting with Finance for the debt collectors.
Yeah, but for now they are observers.
We've got some good lawyers to make some good impact.
I just want to find out if we're accepting 5.3, because my view was that would it be a problem if we delete it altogether?
Comment? Chani? Honorable Chani? No, sir. I really would want to be confused. Why should it be deleted? Because there is a need that we all agree that the government should partner with private business in terms of expanding our infrastructure. But at the same time, we do have got this PPC, PPPs, where also challenges have been noted. Like if you also cite the correction, Department of Correctional Services, where they have suspended some of those things and all of them. But there's a need also to review those particular policies as they are in the current form. Unless Mother's Way has got a convincing reason why it should be deleted.
It's precisely that, because PPPs are in operation already. All over the country. They've been for a number of years. And unless we are saying, because the way it is put here, it's as if really there is a bottleneck somewhere. Okay.
Oh, all right. Thanks. Okay. Agreed. Can we move with a little bit of speed, Honourable Member?
Chair, 5.10 and 5.9 relates to escalation clauses. 5.10, I don't know whether we can suggest that they are totally disallowed. I would suggest we change the word disallowed to minimize escalation clauses. And then the word in order that to be deleted. We have it minimize escalation clauses.
and ensure that professional fees are negotiated down to a minimum level.
Agreed? Okay, and then 5.11, 12 and 13 were my suggestions just to support National Treasury's initiatives in the competitiveness side, increasing labour absorption and the benefits of growth in shares. And then the issue of the community works program was very useful, and I thought we should insert that as well. And then 5.12 was the fiscal support for lower wage employees and new entrants to the labour market. We should support that National Treasury initiative and say it should be strengthened. So that, those are the recommendations that I put in last night. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Vice Chairman?
Yes, Chair, 5.10. Really, Chair, I think there's something wrong with 5.10. We really cannot have National Treasury to say to public works that they must disallow escalation clauses. Because escalation is the consequence of the conditions of contract. And again, escalation comes in relation to the time factor that is involved. There is no way that you can have a contract that takes 12 months or more than 12 months, and then you say that the prices are not going to change, because escalation is actually talking to the change in prices. From the time of tender to the time of implementation, and some of these projects we're talking about, then they may be awarded to a contractor, but only the contractor to start work some 2, 3, 4, 5 months later because of certain hiccups. And therefore the prices cannot be held to be fixed, because really the price levels, they are going up almost every month. And I really don't agree with the sentence, because this is actually a violation of the conditions of contract that are there. And because there is a lot here that has to be done. I mean, my understanding is that the fixed contract where there is no escalation is contract that takes about 3 months, 4 months only. But the minute they go beyond both 4 months and that, then the prices really are affected almost every day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairperson, we're not talking about existing contracts. We're just talking about, and we're not saying minimum, we don't say disallow, we say minimize. So if it's necessary, it can still be in. See, the problem is, when people contract with the state, when you do private to private sector contracts, if you don't complete the job on the completion date, then a penalty kicks in against you, against the contractor. But it doesn't happen in the state. So people don't care, because they've got an escalation clause in their favor. So if they go beyond the completion date, it's on the account of the taxpayer. That's the one point. And the other point is that why we're saying about professional fees. People think when they do business with the state, they can load their accounts. We should change that attitude. Because if they do, if they go from private sector to private sector, these guys sit around the table and fight them down where they can, you know, still have a good fee. But the state is not doing that. They're charging maximum fees in terms of the tariff. And we live in an open market, so why should the state be disadvantaged for that? We just say public works must be more diligently doing their job.
Aren't you talking about competitiveness?
Yeah.
I think we should find a way.
Yeah, I think the real issue that Honorable Coroner is raising, I think they are genuine, but then it is actually supporting the proposal to break another provision, which is not correct. If we are calling for the Department of Public Works to be really serious in monitoring the project management and the implementation of the provisions of the contract, when it comes to the application of penalties, to be done in accordance with the agreement, that's fine. And also, if we ask the Department of Public Works to really deal with variation orders, you see, those are the things that needs more attention, the variation orders and also the application of the penalties when they are due. And when the state is not in wrong, and then that's fine. But to say that you can tamper with the provisions of escalation, I think is proposing a wrong solution for the right complaint that is having, and because that can't be correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think honourable members, Tebo, you want to say something quickly? We need to wrap up.
No, Chair, thanks. I was of the view that both 5.9 and 5, I understand the point that has been raised. But perhaps you need to be specific, because I don't think that if you are to issue a recommendation that says you advise this, they will advise and then what if they don't take that? I mean, it's not strong enough coming from Parliament. So I just wanted to make that point that I think any recommendation that seems to say advise, to me, like we're not saying anything. Yeah. But rather put concrete proposals. So,
I did indicate that in essence what you are talking about is the competitive pricing, basically. And I think we should find a way to capture that and phrase it in our report, in the recommendation. But also, I think we shouldn't underestimate our ability as Parliament, particularly these committees of finance, that if there are issues that we think are not properly handled in a particular department, it will be better outside the fiscal framework process to invite that particular department and engage with that particular department and understand exactly what is happening, so that we are able to put our message across, so that we don't repeat me. So I thought one of the considerations that this committee should look into beyond the fiscal framework is to have an interaction, not only public works, but with a number of other departments, so that we are able to address our concerns as Parliament. So I thought we should leave it at that, and the scriber and the secretariat must find a way to capture the spirit under which you are talking these two clauses. Any other comment on page 7? Marae?
Chairperson, there's just some points that we have sent through to Alan that he obviously couldn't put it in, because you said by the close of yesterday, I sent it through by the close of yesterday, I think it was about 11 o'clock last night, but it was before the close of the day. But Alan has seemed to be closed off earlier than that. So you know, we in the DA, we work 24/7. We work long hours. But that is tongue in the cheek. There's just a couple of things. There's a few things that I think that is more a general principle fiscal stuff that we would like to, you know, it has been captured in some way, but not maybe very prominently. We have talked about the infrastructure spending, which is fantastic. But I think a principle that we feel is that more expenditure must be moved to the productive side, of which infrastructure is one. So maybe we can incorporate, you know, that a broader productive side of the economy, you know, more than just infrastructure, because, you know, agricultural is one. There are quite a number of things that we believe that is on the productive side that should be addressed, but that is not identified the individual, exactly what you have said, which can be dealt with outside the fiscal framework, whichever that is, but the principle of moving more expenditure to the productive side. That is one thing. And then the minister has mentioned something about wasteful expenditure, and we believe that we should get a feedback, at least from National Treasury or the Minister, on how you know, plans of how National Treasury can contain or eliminate wasteful and irregular expenditure from the finance system, and then also the whole procurement process, which is again a principle, and the leakages that we find in the procurement process. That's also something I think that the minister has mentioned. And then another thing that the minister has mentioned that is not in here is maybe a specific more feedback on foreign direct investment, the importance of foreign direct investment for our economic growth and obviously the strengthening of our fiscal framework and our budget process. So that is not radical stuff, but I think it sounds principal stuff that we need to mention, that we have picked up what the minister has anyway said.
I've looked into your submission. Indeed, what you are saying is somehow correct. But what we'll do, because not go through point by point here, I'll work with the scribers and see how to incorporate some of the elements. In by and large, you've addressed some of the issues that you're facing with submission here.
All are very legitimate, including everything.
All right. Honourable, I'm just trying to be sensitive to the fact that we also have got other invited guests here, so that let's not seem to be a little bit disrespectful of the importance of their business with us. Honourable Lee, you want to move?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm still on recommendations. I had indicated earlier that I wanted to speak, and Mr. Chairman, I would like to 5.12 add on to the end, including the introduction of the youth wage subsidy as announced by the Minister. And then, Mr. Chairman, I on one of my recommendations, which I sent through, the point was made that the value of corruption and maladministration could be as high as 30 billion per annum, and we are told we're going to get control of that. And I would like to recommend then that we have a recommendation that the 25 billion over 6 years, which is very, very small amount, considering the great importance of making our economy more competitive and therefore grow, should be ramped up considerably to 10 billion in the current financial year and then 30 billion per annum thereafter, and that those amounts can be from savings obtained from the control of corruption and fraud. And then the last one would be to introduce to remove this allocation for a once-off gratuity for non-returning councillors, and rather allocate these funds for the management of asset mine drainage, which really is at the 208 million allocation, is a drop in the ocean considering the huge problem that is to our country now and in the future.
No, Honourable Lee, I hear what you are saying. But you see, once we start saying the allocation should increase from X amount to X amount and X amount as the committee, I think that's a subject of engagement. For me, the principle should be what has been presented to us, does it take us forward as a country in terms of job creation and stimulating the economy or not? And if it does, I think we should support that as a committee. But to further put on estimated figures as a committee, I think I'm a bit wary to move in that direction. I think in principle we should support what has been presented to us in terms of the stimulus, if you call it that way.
hands up said, I've seen your submission. By and large, it does make sense, but I think we should not get into the details of beginning to redefine the fiscal framework in the manner in which it has been presented to us. Agreed? Okay. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Just a last point, Chairperson. 5.14 says, that the House accepts the revised fiscal framework. We would love to support the report, but that cannot bind us to say that we accept the fiscal framework. So we reserve our rights on that one, and obviously, if that is in, then we cannot support the report. If that is not in, then we support the report.
I think the rules do allow the declaration.
Yes, I accept that.
Yeah.
But obviously, as I said, we would have loved to support the report, but with that in, it's going to be difficult to support the report. Because if we support that, it implies that we cannot not support the fiscal framework, because that is what it says. So in other words, we're committing ourselves already. So I'm just stating that we would have loved to support the report, but if that is in, then we cannot support the report.
The report on the fiscal framework.
Exactly. If the House accepts the report, that's all. But
okay,
that is not what it says there. So if 5.14 can say that the House accepts the report, no problem, then we support that.
Honourable members? Okay. But for record purposes, I think we should put it to the Standing Committee on Finance. Honourable members, to adopt the report. Can we move in a second? Honourable Mtetwa?
So I would like to move the acceptance of the report.
Second there. Honourable Korenov.
All the members of the Select Committee for Finance and the NCLP, we put the report to the Select Committee. Can we get a mover for adoption?
I move, sir.
Thank you. A seconder from that committee, Honourable Mamela. Thank you very much. The report is then duly adopted. Thank you very much, Honourable members.
Thank you very much for your cooperation, Honourable Members. And I do accept that you sometimes do give us difficulties like yesterday, but I knew at the end of the day we'll come to this conclusion. Thank you very much. Honourable Members of Standing Committee on Finance, we remain in behind to continue with our business. Let's take 5 minutes leg stretch. Comfort break. We welcome the presenters of our next item on the agenda, and I must indicate that it is for the first time that they would be interacting with this institution as a committee. I don't know where they've been reporting to in the past, but as you know, honourable members have been tasked by the Office of the Speaker on behalf of Parliament to interact with both SASRIA and the Council of Debt Collectors. Is that so? Yeah. Council for Debt Collectors. So the presentation I'm going to take now is from the Council for Debt Collectors, and it's in relation to their annual report. But I have also solicited the views and the support of
honorable members, that we should take the two presentations together, if possible, and then deliberate so that we can maximize and utilize the time that we have to the best and the best interest of everyone of us in this honorable house. The SASRIA, which is the South African Special Risk Insurance Association, I'm told they are on their way. They were told they are going to present at 11. And I believe if they were going to present at 11, they should be joining us at any moment. So I think what we should do is to allow the briefing by the Council for Debt Collectors on their annual report. We did not communicate with you before what is our expectations as a committee. But what is of critical importance to us in your annual report is also going to be what are the key areas of focus that you'll be looking at, but also what kind of support you need from Parliament in your work. So if you can be able to do that, it will be fine. I'm also told that the by the nature of your work, particularly the next presentation, you seem to be, or they seem to be more on risk specialists, matters. They don't like electronic gadgets, and therefore even their computers have rejected your presentation. Is that so? On a lighter note, what I'm trying to say is that I'm told our equipment is not working here. Therefore, your presentation will have to speak to what we have in terms of black and white copies here, what the technicians are trying to fix the system. And I hope honorable members will be comfortable with that, rather than to wait for the gadgets to be fixed. Yeah. Sorry that our things are not working. you introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Shelly Machara. I'm the Chairperson of the Council for Debt Collection. I would like to thank you very much for the opportunity afforded to us this morning to present to you. I must indicate that although you indicated what you expect from us, we already prepared a presentation which Andres Cornelius, my colleague, is the CEO of the Council. He will be presenting to you this morning. On my left-hand side, I have Eleanor Maris. She's the Chief Financial Officer. If I can just try and allude to what we're going to be covering on the presentation, we'll be giving you the background of the Council, seeing that this is the first time we are presenting to you. We're going to be also touching on what we do in brief and how do we conduct our activities. We're also going to be touching on the governance processes, including the council appointment as well as the composition thereof. We're going to touch on the financial position and the stakeholder management, and in the conclusion, we're going to share with you the year ahead. What do we plan to do for 2012, given the fact that we have the new chairperson, we have the new council, and the new CEO. Without further ado, I would like to hand over to the CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. Members of the committee. Just in brief, the enabling legislation for the council can be found in Act 114/1998, which is the Debt Collectors Act. This act was created to exercise control over the occupation of debt collectors in South Africa, and it legalizes the recovery of fees and remuneration that debt collectors are entitled to.
The overall goal of the Act is to transform the debt collection system in South Africa by monitoring the conduct and professionalism of debt collectors and promoting a culture of good governance within the profession, thus contributing to the protection of the public at large as well as the creditors. The composition of the council is the council consists of 10 members who are appointed by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. The council acts through an executive committee meeting that meets monthly. The council itself meets 4 times a year. Although the Act makes no provision for the formation of an audit committee, the council has created an audit committee. And that audit committee's function is the oversight of the financial risk management of the council and to advise on any audit matters. A comprehensive code of conduct was adopted by the council and published in the government gazette, and this code of conduct is applicable to all registered debt collectors in South Africa. As far as the establishment of the council is concerned, there was a need from debt collectors themselves, who felt that they needed to be regulated, and the Department of Justice also received numerous complaints against debt collectors. And it was then decided to issue an invitation to the Law Reform Commission to investigate this issue. After that investigation, the Law Reform Commission felt that there was a need to regulate the debt collection profession in South Africa, and Parliament noted this need and promulgated the Act at 114/1998 of the Debt Collectors Act. Well, the first council was appointed in 2000, but as the council received no government funding, and there was no government funding available at that stage, and the council had to build its own finances in the beginning, that was done by a grant from the Swiss Development Fund to get the council off the ground and start starting it up in the year 2000. That enabled the council in November 2003 to obtain premises, to appoint an acting CEO and to appoint one staff member, and to put in place the structures needed to start enforcing the Act. By February 2003, the minister was asked to put the Act into operation, and the Act was put into operation in February 2003. The proviso in the Act was that all debt collectors in South Africa had to be registered within a 6-month period, which took it up to August 2003, by which all debt collectors would have had to be registered. In the first 3 months from February onwards, only a total of approximately 215 debt collectors registered. But there was no extension of the time period, and also as a result of vigorous enforcement of the Debt Collectors Act, the registrations have grown, and the current total as of February 2011 is a total of 13,250 registered debt collectors in South Africa. That is not the total of total applications that the council received, though. The total number of debt collectors that the council registered is over 40,000 since the start of the council in 2003. But it has appeared that this is a very volatile industry, and there's a lot of withdrawals and renewals each year. So the membership grows by approximately 1,000 each year. Now, the objectives of the council can be found in section 2.2 of the Debt Collectors Act. And in short, it comes down to the following. It's to regulate the occupation of debt collectors, to regulate the recovery of fees, to register debt collectors, to issue certificates of registration to them, to investigate any complaints against debt collectors where there's a feeling that a debt collector is guilty of a transgression of either the Act, the regulations, or the Code of Conduct. And then if there is such a transgression, then to institute disciplinary proceedings against that debt collector, and if necessary, to convict him and to impose one of the penalties that the Act allows. So in short, members, the council regulates the occupation of debt collectors, they ensure that the debt collectors are registered, and that only those fees that are allowable in terms of the Debt Collectors Act are recovered from debtors. As far as those fees are concerned, I should just add that the fees that a debt collector can charge from a debtor are capped. There's a maximum amount that a debt collector can recover from a debtor, unlike an attorney whose fees are not capped. The council finalizes approximately 520 formal complaints each year and responds to approximately 6,000 telephonic complaints that are resolved each year. As far as the constitution of the council is concerned, the minister appoints a chairperson. In this instance, the minister has appointed Michelle Mashaba, who is a partner in Price Waterhouse, to act as chairperson for the council. The additional members of the council is a magistrate. The current magistrate appointed is Ms. Yolisa Siglobo. She is the chief magistrate of the civil division in Randburg and has just been appointed as an acting judge from the 14th of November this year. The attorney that the minister appointed is Mr. Jan van Rensburg, who is a practicing attorney in Brisk. And then there are four debt collectors that have been nominated by the industry to sit on the council. They are Mr. Rihanna Pereira, Mr. Clyde Johnson, Mr. Arnold Willefield, and Mr. Baker Maseki. The minister also nominated two persons as fit and proper persons to sit on the council, namely Mr. Sher Tanzani and Mr. Peter Durant, who is a member of the Department of Justice. In terms of Section 3, the minister also nominates a person nominated on behalf of consumer organizations in South Africa, and that individual Tony Mulani also sits on the council. The council's term is for a period of 3 years, whereafter the minister then may appoint or must appoint a new council. As far as the secretariat of the council is concerned, myself have been appointed the CEO of the council with effect from the 1st of July of this year. The council is furthermore assisted in carrying out the functions of the Act by a full-time secretariat that consists of 18 members, with 5 departments that report to the CEO, namely a legal department, a registrar, an administration department, and a finance department, and a legal department, and a PR department. As far as the financial position of the council is concerned, honourable members, the council receives no government funding. All its funding, or the majority of its funding, is derived from application fees and subscription fees that debt collectors must pay to the council to obtain their certificate annually. The council has since its inception received unqualified audit reports, and as you can see from the income and expenditure table, the income of the council has generally improved and appears to have stabilized around the 10 million mark from late 2007 to 2011. The council's expenditures have grown, and if the question is in that regard, our CFO would be able to answer it, but generally speaking, it's because of the fact that when the council started out, there were 2 employees in the council. Currently, there are 80, and that's the more personnel required, more space, rental space, more computers, more software licenses, and that is why the reason why the cost grew as long as the income. As far as internal and external liaison is concerned, the internal liaison is done by Mr. Tony Bulani, who, as I previously said, is a person appointed on the council that has been nominated to organizations that could present consumer interest. The council then also makes use of electronic and printed media. The council's policy is that there must be public consultation between debt collectors, between the public, and between any other person that might be affected by the actions of the council. The council also hosts a live website, and on that website, there's information for debt collectors who wish to register in the form that the Act, the regulations, and the code are there, as well as the procedure how to register. But included on that website are all the council judgments from 2006, so that debt collectors can see what type of transgressions other debt collectors have been convicted of, and that the public can also see that the council do when these transgressions take action against debt collectors and prosecute them. Also on the website is a live register so that any member of the public can go through the website and determine whether or not the debt collector is in fact registered. The importance for this, honourable members, is because it's a criminal offence for a debt collector to recover debt from a debtor without being registered as a debt collector. The motivation behind that is because when debt collectors are not registered, they're not bound by the fees that the minister has prescribed, nor are they bound by the code of conduct or the act or the regulation. The council also, in 2010, for the sixth time, embarked on an awareness campaign, and that is a national awareness campaign where the council predominantly focuses on reaching and getting the council's message across to those in rural areas. That is done mostly by way of participating on community radio shows. And for that purpose, the council uses its PR manager, which is Mr. Lekwa Morgan, to go and appear on community radio stations and address those individual listeners in the language in which that specific radio station broadcasts. The council also regularly liaises with debt collectors, as well as with the Department of Justice, with whom the council has a very good relationship. There's annual meetings with the Minister of Justice to discuss the council's problems and challenges. As far as governance of the council is concerned, firstly there's the Executive Committee, who, as I've stated, meets monthly to help the day-to-day administration of the council, and that Executive Committee meeting is chaired by the council's current chairperson as well as two other members. There's a comprehensive risk management strategy in place that is overseen by the Audit Committee and that the Council itself evaluates annually and makes changes as and when required. The Council has also created several policies, with the alias, an employment policy, an emergency staff loan policy, an acquisition policy, as well as an emergency acquisition policy, an investment policy, and a travel and remuneration policy. For the year ahead, chairperson members, there's a new chairperson and a new council that came into operation at the beginning of this year. With that comes new ideas. Also, the council has saved, in financial terms, savings with the appointment of a new council by restructuring the entire way that the council processes applications for debt collectors and their registration. The council is also looking for the year ahead in trying to limit its costs by obtaining fixed property and not pay the high rental costs that the council at the moment has to pay for. That is still subject to an approval of Parliament of some amendments that is required. As things are at the moment, the council cannot purchase fixed property, but that is something for the year ahead. There's also a new CEO, and at the council's AGM in November, there will be a new strategic plan discussed and formulated for the council for the year ahead. The reason why this was not done earlier is that the council was only appointed in January, and the council's AGM in November deals with the strategic plan formulation level. There has also been a program created for council induction that also kicked off in November, where the Institute of Directors will train council members on what is exactly expected of those council members and their function. The council has also embarked on a new direction, and that is done through changes in the Act, or proposed changes in the Act. And those changes are firstly that the council will take over, administer and finalise trust accounts of debt collectors who become inactive. So whether they become inactive through the withdrawal of their registration or become inactive because the council or they pass away, or they've just stopped practicing, the council will take over those trust accounts, administer them, and finalise them. And the motivation for that, members, is because that is to the benefit of the creditors of the debt collector, who has money in that trust account that still has to be distributed, as well as to the public, because of some of the payments in that trust account is done by way of emolument orders, and therefore it's a necessity that somebody takes over and administer those accounts and finalise them. Furthermore, in the new amendment, is the council has made provision for learned collectors. And the motivation behind that, chairperson, is that there's a need to allow more South Africans into the debt collecting occupation. and where there might be a hindrance as to the registration and annual fees that have to be paid, the council has decided to propose and promote a learnership program where the fees can be drastically reduced to enable more people to access the debt collecting industry. There's also provision made in the budget for next year that the council should take a more active role in the training of debt collectors, and that will also be put in place during the course of the year ahead. The last item on my slideshow, Chairperson, is that it has been identified by the council as well as by the minister that there is a need to register attorneys and debt collectors. And the reason for that is because attorneys are not subject to a cap on their fees when it comes to debt collecting. And there is attorneys whose only function is the collection of debt. We're not talking about attorneys in general, we're talking about attorneys who buy books, and that is their only function. In this regard, there are attorneys who have call centers of 1,000 people who recover debt, and this is a need that the council has identified and will be discussed with the department during the course of the new year further. The Chairperson, I thank you very much for the time afforded this. The council will now answer any questions that any of the members will have.
One of the members. Honorable Yenge, followed by Ma Adams. Then we'll take Honorable Kurenwolf, followed by Honorable Tetwa. Honorable Swart. Schaefer. Schaefer, oh, okay. Ma Tolle, afterwards, in that order. Now you've long been recognized. Honorable Marais, you and I must then take an agreement to use our first names. Okay.
Thank you, Sir President. Let me first appreciate the elaborate report that has been given. It is, of course, a learning curve on part of us because we are not very aware of the organization. My first question, Chair, or elaboration that I would appreciate from the CEO, one is around the structural arrangement of the organization. How do you exist in provinces? I hope you are a national structure then. How are you represented in provinces? Or how are provinces maybe, how do you communicate? Is there any link that you have with the other spheres of government? And then the human resource establishment. Do you have the necessary and appropriate staff that is actually responsive to your objectives? The other one, Chair, is around the relationship between this organization and the sheriff. Are there any formal kind of relationship that you have with the sheriff? In case of your customers who have been found on the other side of the law, do you blacklist them? Is it blacklisting a part of such sentence? And then on monitoring, how do you monitor your customers in terms of ensuring that during the progress of their work you do the monitoring, and maybe at the end of the financial year, if at the end of the financial year you do some evaluation kind of exercises. Then lastly, the new chairperson is termed to be coming with new ideas, the new CEO with new everything. But what is the meaning of that? Is that an assertion that says the previous chairperson was actually belonging to the old order? Thank you, sir.
Note the questions and then respond at the end. Madam,
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on the internal and externalizing the awareness campaigns, how successful are these campaigns? Do you have a measuring tool? And secondly, Chair, does the committee promote in the campaigns savings and how to save for consumers? And then I'd like them to speak on the income and expenditure from, say, 2003 to 2011. I know they said that the staff complement has increased, but they had a big saving, I should name it, in 2003, and by 2011 it was not so big. Thank you.
I can't remember. Let me go then. Chairperson, I am on, unfortunately the slides are not numbered, but on the financial position of the council. If you look at your financial year 2006-2007, even before, your income was about double your expenditure. And that was, and then the next year it's about 30%, but then something seriously went wrong in 2009 and 2010. Suddenly your expenditure is what your income is. And that is now the trend. You know, are you less effective? Why is that the case? Or have you just looked and say, we've got this income, let's spend it? I really want to know that. Was that the attitude? And then secondly, if you had a surplus, you had millions of surpluses, what happened to the surplus? Is it going to the Treasury? Or is it going where? And if it is going to the Treasury, is that not the reason why you're starting spending it? So I want to know, because it's a serious question, you know, you're taking this money out of the economy. It's not, obviously, when you pay a fee, even if I pay to Cipro or whatever, it's money out of the economy I could have spent somewhere else. Now, if you just spend because you've got the income, it's the wrong attitude. And we need to change that in South Africa. Otherwise, we will not get this economy going.
You're covered. Honourable Mteto.
Thank you, Chair.
Mare.
Thank
Mare.
You, thank you, Chair Mfumari. Thank you. Just a link on what my colleague has said, and that links to the obligation towards consumers as well. I get the impression that there's a lot of rights and benefits, but you haven't elaborated much on the obligations of this industry towards consumers and towards the economy. There is, I think, it's a belief that once with a debt collector, always with a debt collector. It doesn't let you go, because that means money to them. And, I mean, you know, if a consumer starts to perform regularly and within his obligations, surely they must get the acknowledgement and the recognition that they are paying their obligations properly and that they must maybe get off the bad credit record. But there's a belief that once with a debt collector, you know, you are stuck forever and that you are reliable on them. Also, you know, and I mean that links to that money that you also spend and that you raise, because it comes from consumers that are now dependent and on you, and also in that web, if I can use that phrase. So I would love to know more about your obligation towards regularizing consumers in their spending patterns, and what guidance or capacitating do you do towards consumer behavior?
in terms of spending and debt as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just three questions from me. I'd just like clarity from something you said. It sounded like there was no obligation on debt collectors to register with your council. Is that correct or not? And if it is correct that there is no obligation, then what security do you that consumers have? And what control, I mean, are they completely subject to no control whatsoever? And if they are, then we need to look at that legislation again, in my view. Secondly, what are your subscriptions? I mean, it seems like you're dealing quite well without government funding, so there's certainly no reason for us to look at giving you government funding if you are managing as you are. What are the subs for the members? Have you had any complaints about the amount, and are you able to collect those easily? And thirdly, just on the question of monitoring, take a bit further than what, how do you monitor the processes that are followed by the collectors, that they are in fact compliant with the law? Thanks.
Mama. Thank you, Chairperson. I don't expect answers today because I have to rush to another meeting. I think we'll invite you to the Portfolio Committee on Justice, because by the very fact that you, the chairperson, is appointed by the Minister of Justice, you fall under our scope. And what I would like to know when you come there, I would like you to bring your audited financial statements, because although you don't have to get government funding, I'm interested in looking at the protection of the consumers, because the trust accounts obviously have got money from the general public. I would also like to know your discussion with the minister. You can bring it at that stage. I was just discussing with my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you. You would divide the responses amongst yourself.
Thank you, Chairperson. I deal with the responses that are not financial nature first, and the rest of the representatives from the council will deal with those relating to financial issues. Firstly, the council, because there's only 18 staff members, is centralised in Gauteng. There's no offices for the council in other provinces. But the council's control exercised over the entire South Africa, and all debt collectors that register are registered in Gauteng, and they are controlled from Gauteng. But should the need arise, for argument's sake, disciplinary matters against a specific debt collector, the council then travels to wherever that debt collector and the witnesses in that action is situated. Furthermore, when the council embarks on an awareness campaign, it globally, the council, when it sends out a newsletter, sends out a newsletter to all its members, wherever they may be in South Africa. The human resources at the council at the moment have, the 18 members, they have been able to cope with the workload. From time to time, if I can use an example, additional personnel are required. If the Department of Justice requests that a system be put in place to take over and administer trust accounts of debt collectors, and before they allow that to be written into an amendment to ensure that the council has that in place, and additional personnel is appointed for that purpose. But at the moment, the workload is being managed by the 18 personnel that is in the council full employed. The relationship between the council and the sheriff, there's no formal relationship between the council and the sheriff. I think I should just reiterate that the council controls only the debt collecting profession. The sheriff, that's a process of court. Even though the council may receive a complaint from a member of the council, of the public, about the conduct of a specific sheriff, there's no formal relationship between the council and the board of sheriffs at all. The council only makes use itself of sheriffs when it has to serve the documents that the Act requires us to serve on a debt collector if we want to charge it. And that is in reality the only link between the council and sheriff. We also make use of sheriff when it is required. As far as blacklisting is concerned, one has to remember that the council doesn't in any way take part in the relationship between a creditor, a debt collector, and a debtor. The council blacklists nobody. We don't even subscribe to the blacklisting system. The council will receive complaints from a member of the public saying, I have been unfairly blacklisted by a debt collector. And that will then be investigated by the council, and if it's decided that that listing was unfair, the council will take steps against that debt collector in terms of its own code of conduct. But generally speaking, that relationship between the blacklisting bureau and a debtor is controlled or handled by the credit ombudsman. That is his function, it's not the council's function. So even though we will intervene when the complaint has merit and can instruct the debt collector to remove somebody's name from the list, it's not something that the Act provides for. So we can ask, but we can't force the debt collector to remove somebody's name from the blacklisting system. That can only be done by the credit ombudsman, that is his domain, and not the council. As far as the monitoring is concerned, the council monitors debt collectors by the complaints that we receive from the public, whether or not they are busy engaging in conduct which is against the code that has been promulgated, and against the Act and against the regulations. And the financial regulation of debt collectors takes place through the fact that the council receives annually, in terms of the Act, an audited financial report from the auditor of that debt collector to show that the amount in trust has been properly maintained and managed, and the amount that has been in that trust account has been paid to whoever it was supposed to be paid to. So that is the council's monitoring tools for debt collectors. I trust that those address the questions or the answers that I can address from your questions. As far as the awareness campaigns are concerned, there is a measurement tool for the awareness campaign. If at the back of the council's annual report, if you will just grant me one moment to make a pardon. During 2010, the council reached approximately, and that's on the last page of the report. I'm not 100% sure, I have to confess exactly how they calculate how many listeners you reach through radio broadcast. But what was received from the company that the council employed to do this awareness campaign was an amount of 5,511,000 listeners in the province. So that was what was reached to the awareness campaign. Furthermore, the council, when there are awareness campaigns, also monitors the effectiveness of those awareness campaigns by comparing the amount of telephone calls and requests from members of the public that the council receives after somebody has lodged a complaint. As far as savings and savings to the consumer is concerned, honourable member, the fact of the matter is that in the council's, in the Act's ambit, it says that the council's function is the regulation of the debt collectors, the debt collecting industry, or the debt collecting occupation. So, part of the council's function, or is not prescribed in the Act, that part of the council's function is in reality protection of the public. It does so through the effective control or regulation of the debt collecting industry. In that if a debt collector transmits a transgression and it's a transgression of the Act code or regulation, he will be, in all probability, prosecuted and a fine will be imposed against him. So the protection of the public lies in that. If I have a look at the annual report, part of the council's penalties that they can impose is they can order a debt collector to repay amounts to debtors or to complainants in reality. Whether that complainants are debtors or whether those complainants are the credit granters that instructed the debt collector. And if I look at the total amount that has been ordered to be repaid by debtors to or debt collectors to other their clients or to debtors is an amount of $633,000 that debt collectors were ordered to pay back. Now that amount, or that can happen because it's provided for in the Act. The council can either withdraw the registration of a debt collector, which means you have to stop practicing. It can suspend his registration. It can impose a fine on him up to an amount of $100,000 per charge. And it can suspend any portion of that fine. It can make an order for repayment where the council or that finding of that committee is that somebody has been prejudiced. And it can make an order that cost has to be paid. Now, the highest fine that the council has imposed, and I've been with the council, is a fine of approximately just over $1.2 million to a debt collector. That specific matter is under appeal in the Supreme Court at the moment, but that is the highest fine that the council have imposed. In that specific instance, there were no orders for repayment because the money was never in reality collected. But the charges were so severe that the council felt that that was an appropriate sentence against that specific debt collector. Then, the income and expenditure and why it rose during 2003 and 2011, I think, would be best addressed by either the chairperson or by the CEO.
Thank you, Andres. I will start by touching on the question on why are we always saying we have new ideas, because we have the new chairperson and the new council and the new CEO. If you look at the 2011 chairperson's report, we acknowledging the job well done by the previous chairperson and his council, and some of the council members are really, you know, continued. They've been reappointed. We believe that, you know, we really laid the foundation for us. All we're saying is that as the new council members, you know, youngish, you know, we have the opportunity to take, you know, the council to the next level. And I have examples. I think Andres has already alluded to that during his presentation. For example, you know, I think ever since the council inception, we haven't really had time to review the strategy, and we are saying come November at the strategic section, we intending to review that strategy, and out of that process, we're going to come up with a lot of new activities which are going to take us to the next level, particularly when it comes to performance information. As you know, that we are not government-funded, we are not subjected to PFMA, but, you know, whatever we do in this organization, we try to bring in, you know, good best practices from government. For example, performance information templates for reporting purposes. So that will be part of our strategic session. Governance processes. It doesn't really mean that the previous chairperson didn't embrace governance processes, but, you know, I am from a governance, environment, and I believe that as the chairperson of the council, you know, I want to see, you know, us embracing all the principles of corporate governance. Okay, the next question was around the financial position of the council. You alluded to the fact that in 2006, the income doubled, and starting with 2010 and 2011 financial years, there was a slight increase, whereas the expenditure was growing drastically. We have reasons for that, honorable member. One of the main reasons, I think Andres indicated that ever since the inception of the Council for Debt Collection, we never had an increase in registration fees. You know, it still kept the same, but obviously in terms of inflation, you will appreciate that, you know, the expenses are not going to be remaining static. And when we started with the Council, we had a very tight structure. Right now we have 18 people within the organization. As long as we have an increase in the sufficient, it goes together with the extra space, it goes together with salaries, you know, all the related expenses. The other issue really will be the economic downturn. In one of the chairperson's reports, we are saying although there was an economic downturn, there was not a serious impact on the council, but there was an impact. Again, let me just check my notes here. I spoke about the inflation. I spoke about the fact that we didn't increase the fees. I think, yeah, in a way, as long as you increase the establishment, you'll have relative salaries. We also promoted one of the people within the organization who is now responsible for public relations. Hence, you see, you know, the fact that we reached plus or minus 5 million throughout the country in terms of creating awareness of what we do. I don't know if really my answers, you know, respond appropriately to your questions.
Unfortunately not, but let's when I think there was a request to see the audited financial statements, then we can make a calculation on what's the percentage of the budget spent on salaries and so on, but yes, let's leave it for now.
I just forgot to address one other financial related question. Your question was around the surplus. The surplus amount of, I think, is over 30 million. Your question was, what did we do? What do we want to do with this money and where is it? We have an investment policy. It's one of the policies which we reviewed, I think it was 9-10. And the reason why we reviewed that policy is because we felt it's necessary for us to really make sure that we play around with the money we have. Not playing around in terms of spending, but making sure that we invest appropriately with the relevant banks. I remember I was still the chairperson of the audit committee by then. We decided that we have to diversify, you know, our investment. At the moment, we have APSA and Investec. For us to take a decision to invest in those organizations, we really did an exercise, checking as to where exactly we can get the good returns. That's what happened. And the other reason why we decide to keep that money, as we said, we are not funded by government. And if you look at the financial statements, overall we require 10 million per year to survive or to run our operations. So that 30 million, we had an exercise which tells us that, you know, if we have maybe at least reserves which will cover a period of 3 years, irrespective of what happens, we can be able to survive going forward.
Okay. I think, honourable members, do you still have another input from the side?
Indeed, Chairperson, I have addressed all the questions. I just want to add something to what Ms. Shaba addressed you on, honourable member, and that is that also one has to take in mind that the amounts paid were covered by debt collectors are paid into the trust account. The attorneys have a fidelity fund, where if any money is stolen from that trust account, you can claim against that fidelity fund. The council has no fidelity fund. And part of the motivation to acquire or to generate reserves and a reserve capacity is so that the council at some stage can put into effect a fidelity fund to cover the monies being held by debt collectors and trusts. And that is it's just another reason why we have an investment policy and investing money. We've done a calculation, and it appears that we will require between 25 and 35 million just for a fidelity fund. The Law Society last year paid out 13 million rand from their fidelity fund. So their money that is there at present, that 13 million, is to cover operational costs for 3 years, and it is supposed to keep on growing until we can establish a fidelity fund, or unless government assists with the establishment of such a fund. As far as, I just want to make one thing very clear, Chairperson and honourable members. When I say the council's function is not the protection of the public, that doesn't mean that the council's obligation is not towards protecting the public. The council takes that obligation incredibly serious, and therefore if there's any transgression of the fees that a debt collector is allowed and has been prescribed by the minister, the council takes severe action against those debt collectors who charge more than what the minister has allowed. If I use an example, if you owe 100 rand and a debt collector approaches you, you cannot pay in fees more than 100 rand. The fees are capped to the capital amount or an amount of 700 rand, 700 odd, whichever is the smallest. So if a member of the public complains to the council that there's a 100 rand account and the debt collector wants 240 rand in fees, the council prosecutes that debt collector. So we take that obligation incredibly seriously. Also, what the council takes serious as far as the consumers are concerned, if there's any allegation of improper dealings in a debt collector's trust account, the council has the authority to appoint an auditor to go and have a look at that trust account and investigate it, and in that manner
to protect the interest of whoever money is in that trust account. The money that the council receives does not come from consumers. Consumers don't pay the council for the advice we give them and the help we give them. The only money the council receives is a subscription and registration fee that is received from debt collectors. We receive no money from the general public. And as far as consumer behavior is concerned, there was one other question, is there an obligation on debt collectors to register? Yes. If they don't register, it's a criminal offense. But that, unfortunately, is something that then falls in the domain of the police force to charge those individuals criminals.
Okay. Unfortunately, because of time, we'd have to stop here from our side of the committee. But as I said in my opening remarks, that this is your first interaction with the committee. And the basis on which we are interacting is your annual report. And clearly, in terms of operational issues, there's more that the committee would want to engage with you on. And by so saying, I'm saying we would have to come back to you and probably invite you, not just based on the annual report, but in terms of the space in which you operate. My assumption would be, at the moment, why you are appearing before our committee is precisely because there's a process within National Treasury that seeks to streamline financial market activities or activities in the financial market, issues of credentials and regulations. I think it's called Twin Peak approach. We would have to come back to you within the context of your role and the role of the FSB and so on and so forth, so that we can come closer to you and also understand more intimately what is it that we may need to do to assist you. We are not here just to provide oversight in terms of seeing the difficulties that you have for the consumers only, but how do you make this institution more effective? I would not want to go deeper because would actually be more comfortable as a committee when we interrogate even your audited financials, not only at that level, but also just to see your mandate, you know, in terms of the establishment, in terms of the act, and the appointments of the board, and so on and so forth. So I would want to say, let's appreciate the information that you've shared with us for now, but we'll definitely not wait for the next annual report before you see us, or before we see you. We're going to make sure that we find a way to interact with you more on a regular basis so that we help other initiatives that are taking place within the financial sector to be in line with the overall strategic objective of what National Treasury is trying to achieve in terms of market credentials and market regulations and all those things. Thank you very much for coming. We're really looking forward to see you in the next round of our deliberations. We will come back to you in writing and invite you. And I think at that time, we'd have actually have had the time to reflect on your annual report and other issues as the committee so that we have a clear understanding of what is it that we want you to focus on. Thank you very much for now. You are released.
and we'd like to invite the next presenter to set up their system. I see our things are now working. The gadgets have come back. All right. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. We're looking forward to engaging with you.
Thank you. I have already welcomed you in your absence, knowing fully well that you're supposed to be here at 11. So, but we also acknowledged your presence when we started the meeting much earlier, when you took the first presentation. Equally, and I'm sure you know this, it's for the first time that you're appearing before this committee. It is a learning exercise on our part, who you are. So I don't think you anticipate the very robust interaction with this committee at the moment. More so because it's Friday, you know. You still have a weekend to enjoy. So we will leave everything in your hands just to take us through. Introduce yourself. We've got a very thin committee today because honorable members have been working flat out since the budget was presented, and other engagements have cropped up, but a few of us who are here would be able to carry the load and lay the basis for further engagement with yourself. You're welcome. We're in your hands. We'll try to share as much information as yourself, but let's also be mindful of time at the same time. Over to you. My list indicates that we have Mr. Cedric Masondo, the MD, and then Karen Pepler, Financial Director, Mukhorosi Lebete, National Treasury Representative. Where's Mukhorosi? Okay, at the back. All right. You'll decide who's going to lead, and then formally introduce yourself, and so that we know who's who. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. My name is Adam Salmi. I'm a non-executive director at Sandia, and I'm the chair of the audit committee. And I believe I'm also responsible for delaying this meeting a little bit because I arrived a little bit late at the airport, for which I apologize. The plane was about to take off. It had a technical problem, and then after a while it didn't have one. So I'm happy to be here.
In the interest of time, we've got a slide presentation that we're going to try and compress without losing the essence of what we want to run through. My job is really just to give a bit of background to SADLR as an establishment in relation to how they started and what they currently do. And then we'll move into the actual operations of the business, where we've got the two executive directors. But we'd be happy to take questions and perhaps share some of our observations on trends and tendencies in the business. The SADLR started out as a non-profit organization following the 1976 drive, and I think as someone said, that SADLR is one of the outcomes of the apartheid era, starting in a brutalized past and growing into perhaps one of South Africa's beautiful children, and as we go into the future. So it's got a lot of history. It's got in starting in that dark past, it really has, I think, become a beacon for this type of insurance and marketing to this kind of risk in the world in a global sense. So what we really have here is one of the South Africa's beautiful children. In 1976, private insurance companies provided what is known as conventional riot and civil commotion cover. But with a widespread dissent resulting in material damage in various parts of the country over that time, the formalized insurance sector declared the situation as no longer normal and therefore refused to accept and do riot insurance, as they were allowed to do in terms of the norms of private sector insurance cover for riots. The government, as the insurer of last resort, assisted the insurance industry to form a Section 21 company where they pooled premiums to provide this type of cover to South African citizens who might then have needed it. And in 1998, an act of parliament changed the holding company or the private sector company into a limited liability company, and we have SADLR as it appears today with the state as the sole shareholder. At the time when this was done, there was a decapitalization of the Section 21 company, and an amount approaching 11 billion rand was paid back out of the funds that had accumulated in the Section 21 company at the time back to government. SADLR is governed by two primary acts of legislation. The one is the Reinsurance of Material Damage and Losses Act, which really is the founding legislation which sets out the mandate for SADLR to operate the kind of perils and so on that it does offer for insurance, and outlines also the state's position as primary shareholder. The conversion of the SADLR Act is referred to that really to transfer a Section 21 company into a proper state-owned private enterprise and allow SADLR to operate as a full insurance company within the private sector. The kind of perils that SADLR insures is the first item, any act directed to overthrow the government by means of fear, violence, or terrorism. This was the so-called political riot concept that was introduced following the 1976 riots, where the insurers at the time tried to distinguish between what they deemed to be a normal riot and what they then deemed to be a political riot.
And the distinction really was that it was a normal riot aimed at the overthrow or destabilization of the government is a de facto political riot. And so they decided that they were happy to ensure normal rights, but they weren't happy to ensure political rights. As things have happened, and particularly since the 9/11 terrorist attack in New York and the United States, this idea of terrorism and the idea of risk related to terrorist types of risk has really become a global phenomenon. And it is true that through its experiences, South Africa has now got one of the oldest histories of ensuring this type of risk and managing this type of risk, and we've become global experts at it. And we've expanded our sphere of cover so that it no longer covers just terrorism or acts of terrorism or so-called political risk, but also designed to cover social unrest and any sort of public disturbance, including normal riots and strikes, you know, under one umbrella. And this is what makes Sanitare truly unique in the world. It is the only insurance company in the world that provides under one policy the totality of the package of covers around civil unrest, whether of a political or purely social nature, whether it is work-related or political, that any act of random damage and so on will be covered by our policy, including the damage arising from any acts that might be taken by a law enforcement agency, a legitimate law enforcement agency, a government, a state police or whatever, in trying to curb and control that damage. The business model is simply that through pooling these perils and these risks under one umbrella, one is able to reduce the price because we're spreading it across a broader segment. So we're looking at affordable premiums. Because SASRA is a de facto monopoly in South Africa in the way that it is the only company that can operate and provide this insurance cover in South Africa, it is done on a non-refusable and non-cancelable basis. So when somebody comes to SASRA and says they want this insurance cover, SASRA is obliged to accept. And then thereafter, it doesn't matter how many claims they have, SASRA is not allowed to cancel the policy. And that is a unique feature. The distribution channel is through insurance companies and brokers through to their clients. Reinsurance is bought as per a normal insurance company to protect the balance sheet. SASRA boasts a very strong balance sheet, partly through some investments which were left behind following the decapitalization of the Section 21 company. And it makes sure that it follows proper and due process through risk management exercises to invest in surplus capital and to make sure that it is all around the well-run and well-rounded company. Thank you very much. I'll hand over to Cedric to run through the business operation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2009, SASRA, the company, decided to formulate a strategic objective that will take SASRA to 2014. And as you can see, these are the strategic objectives for us as a company. And obviously, as a business, we want to make sure that we've got a sustainable company and increase our premium and also manage our expense. Also, we want to make sure that we are relevant. We are producing products that are in line with what the conventional insurers are doing. And one of the strategic objectives as a company is to make sure that we enhance and introduce new products that will respond to the new demand. Also, one of the strategies was to make sure that as a government company, we adhere to good corporate governance. And also have a business that is run efficiently and eliminate wastage. The fourth objective was to make sure that we invest in human capital. I think as a company we want to make sure that we develop our people and invest in the people. And lastly, we realized that customer centricity is quite a critical issue for a financial service company. People are dependent on our product, on our service, so customer centricity is quite critical. So these are the objectives. And what I want to share with you is the financials in terms of the gross written profit, what we've achieved in 2010-2011. And this is just a breakdown of type of classes of business that we write as a company. And this is not, apart from the perils, but the class of business that we write, it's not unique. We write the normal material damage classes. If somebody wants to buy insurance for motor or for building or for goods in transit, or for contract rates, so we do. As you can see, Honorable Members and Mr. Chairperson, our premium for 2010-2011 was more than $1 billion. For us, this was a big achievement to reach $1 billion, because that moves us to another segment in terms of our size. And this was a great news for us, because we achieved this with a double-digit growth. I mean, this slide shows the company when in 2001, and you can see 2001, the gross written premium for the company was only $27 million. Over a period of 10 years, we've managed to increase that premium to just over $1 billion. And the last 3 years has been extremely good for us. Whilst we've made good progress on the top line, the claim has been a major problem for us. Adam has highlighted why the company was formed. When the company was formed, the main reason was to cover political riots. And since 1994, we've seen a peaceful country, and political riot claims is no longer a big issue. But the last 4 years, we've seen an increase in riots and strike-related claims. And we've also witnessed something new, which wasn't when the company was formed, the service delivery strikes. And you can see 2011, there was an increase of labor strike. That will be the people destroying properties while they're on strike, from 55% to about 70%. And you also see an increase in the service delivery strike. And this is the new trend that you're seeing as a company, which is new to us. And this is bringing a new dimension into the company. The next slide, I just want to indicate to you that the impact, especially 2010-2011, has been an increase in claims amount. I mean, the previous year, the claims was just below 50 million, but it balanced in 2010-2011 just to over 200 million. Unfortunately, we're seeing the same trend this year. The claim figures are increasing, and mainly coming from the labor strike. The loss ratio, this is just a slide about the loss ratio. This is what we use in the insurance industry to measure the profitability of our business. This just measures the claims versus the premium. As you can see, this is a volatile slide, but 2010-2011, there was a huge increase in number of claims, and that reduces our profitability, because we're paying more claims than the previous year. And unfortunately, like I've said, this trend is continuing. We thought last year was just a once-off, but the trend seems to be the new trend, where we're going to have more damage caused by rioters. And I'll just let Karen talk to you about the financials.
Good day. In the interest of time, I will only take you through the items that haven't been highlighted by my colleagues. The single biggest expense on Sadio's income statement is insurance premiums ceded to reinsurers. This is costs we pay to protect our balance sheet. There is three separate treaties. The first treaty provides catastrophe cover. That's covering the events of catastrophic events such as terrorism. The second treaty covers is a quota share cover, which you pay a percentage of your premium, and then they would pay a percentage of your claim. And then the third treaty is specific for Sadio RAP products. The next item is investment income. which comprises interest income, dividends, realized and unrealized gains and losses on our investments. It's clearly that our investment income has declined significantly last year, and that is made due to the reduction in interest rates as well as the volatility of the equity markets. The next item I want to take you through is solvency of its property and associates. This is a private equity investment, and it's invested that will mature in approximately 3 years. The profit before tax has decreased by 11.9%, and that is due to the significant increase in claims during the 2011 years. The next slide shows Sagria's capital growth over the last 10 years. In 2000, Sagria had $894 million in capital, and over the 10 years, Sagria has built it up to about $3.4 billion. That is an average increase of 16% per annum. The reason why I spend the whole slide on projecting the capital growth is that capital is the most important item on an insurer's balance sheet, as the SSB prescribes the minimum capital that is required by an insurer. At the current moment, it's calculated at 25% of the insurer's net written premium, but this method of calculating is changing under the new SAM regime, which the capital will be calculated at to be sufficient to cover the risk the insurer is exposed to. The next slide is an overview just of the total assets on Sagria's balance sheet that comprises of the majority of the assets is investment, and it's liquid investments in bank and cash and a portion in equities. The net amount is $3.6 billion under investment, and the balance is made up of property, plant and equipment and trade and other receivables. On the liability side, it's mainly insurers claims outstanding as well as trade creditors. The next slide deals with just some highlights, financial highlights we wanted to share. The first one is the Sagria solvency ratio. This is determined or calculated as per the SSB. In 2011, we had a solvency ratio of 575%. And that the requirement is 25%. So we were very well capitalized, but we also realized that the method the SSB was using wasn't really adequate for Sagria, specific type of risk it covers. In the current year, we have started implementing, or we actually participated in the first quiz under the new SAM regime, and that figure now has dropped to 156%, which indicates that we do have enough cover, but it's more in line with what we expected it to be. The next point talks about the capital reserve. In the end of 2011, Sagria had $3.4 billion, but what we need in cover, which we'll talk to you one in 200 year event, is around $10 billion, and that is where your reinsurance comes in to reach that gap. Then in 2011, the dividend policy was approved, and Sagria paid $153 million in dividends. The loss ratio, as Cedric explained, at the end of 2011 was 26.3%, and the current year to date it sits at 24.6%, which is what we expected. The management expense ratio is currently 11.6%, and that's a clear indication that we are attempting to manage our expenses as best as possible. And the profit before tax was $660 million, of which we contribute 2% towards CSI initiatives, which Cedric will take you through.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, just before Cedric goes on to the CSI, I think something that's quite important for this committee to perhaps understand from these numbers and from some of the comments that Cedric has made. Riot insurance cover and terrorism cover is essentially designed for particular acts of terror. So you're looking at single events with almost cataclysmic proportions. That's the way you would normally look at it. So if you look at some of the big events that have happened, there'd be in Madrid, there were attacks on the trains in Kenya and Nairobi, we had attacks on hotels, single sort of attacks. The 9/11 is probably the best example that we had. The attack in Mumbai on the cricket team and that sort of thing. So single events with huge outcomes and the potential for really large losses. When we look at this issue of capital, the capital requirement for that sort of cataclysmic event for Sandia is of the order of 10 billion, and that would foresee a major strike perhaps in the Sandton CBD or a major shopping complex in South Africa or a series of complexes. And that is cast Sandria's role as a primarily a catastrophe insurer. The problem with, as Cedric has highlighted, with what we term the attritional claims, the normal claims which are coming through, should by nature be quite small. It should be of the order of 4-5%. What we are seeing is a trend in social dislocation, social unrest, delivery, whatever term we want to put to it. But random acts of violence and damage directed at government property, at local population and so on, running at certainly more than 25% of the kind of premiums that we are currently is collecting. This not only undermines the capital base that Sandia is trying to build up, it forces us into the purchase of additional reinsurance cover to provide greater security in the event of that single event. But it also begins to point to real challenges within the socioeconomic community that needs to be managed. One needs to understand that despite the fact that we've got Sandia as a private limited liability company, the government still is the reinsurer of last resort. And these issues of social unrest and so on eventually ends up at the state door. So there is a kind of a responsibility both from private and the public sector to really look and examine at the root causes of these issues and try and manage those things down into a more normalized environment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just lastly on our side, I think we, as an organization, we're trying to run the organization profitably and sustainable organization, but you also realize that we operate in an environment where we need to contribute to the society. CSI is quite important to us, and CSI is aimed at youth and education. And I'm not going to go through all our CSI initiatives, but the first one, which I think we are proud of as a company, which has been championed by our chairperson, Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, is the SADC. This is aimed at sponsoring the actuaries from the previous disadvantage. And this one, we've invested as a company more than 23 million to date, and we invest about 5 million annually. And this one, with the result, we've seen 7 qualified actuaries as a result of this program. And there are about 70 that have graduated, and we believe that in 3 years' time, this figure will double the number of qualified actuaries. And this is aimed, I mean, not just in urban areas. This program is aimed at all South Africans and people that are good in math and that want to pursue this career. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think your presentation was quite short, but very direct to the issues that we would love to engage with you.
Honorable members, Marais, Honorable Marais, my friend, followed by Honorable Luyenge.
Thank you, Chair. Just that last, just my first question on CSI. It seems like you're very proud on what you've done. You haven't mentioned anything what you've done for the disabled. Isn't that part of your CSI? If it's not part, why is it not part? If it is part, what have you done? You haven't reported anything on that. So you've been very quiet on that. Then secondly, just on your premium income, what was the increase in premiums over the last couple of years, the percentage-wise? What is the justification for that? Why? I mean, how do you determine that? Then the last question is about your profitability, and specifically the dividends paid out, obviously to the state revenue fund that went. Now, is that the objective, to be so profitable that it is another form of tax to the consumers? Because most certainly, you know, this fund is to cover the expenses of South Africa, and not to increase the revenue for the state. Now, if consumers contribute and you don't need the money, in other words, you declare a dividend, give it to the government, then obviously you don't need to increase your premium. So I mean, how do you justify that? Because really, I mean, this is not the objective of this company, is to be a cash cow for the state revenue fund. That is a principle. I understand that you are a company. I understand that you must work on profitability basis. I understand that you must be sustainable. I understand that fully. But if this insurance, your Sasria, don't need the money to put into the reserve, you know, for rainy seasons to come, why do you then ask the consumers to contribute to that? And then part of that question, what is your projections in terms of the risk of Sasria? You know, where you explain the history. What is your projections of the risk involved? Because certainly the projected risk or the expected risk will determine your policy in terms of premium and dividends. Thank you very much. I think that's a moral question as well.
You just note the question and then you respond.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Mine is around the inflation management. How do you ensure that as you execute your work, but also to the benefit of the organization, you should manage inflation? Or do you apply an automatic kind of inflation management where in the beginning, in the contract, you may be compel the contributor to contribute a certain percentage on a yearly basis so as to manage inflation? And then secondly, Chair, how do you deal with suspense accounts? I'm referring to maybe unclaimed monies as well as declined claims. How do you deal with such account if you have? Thank you, sir.
Well, Honorable Teto,
your structural arrangement as well in terms of profits.
Over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'd like to tackle the more difficult questions around premium rates, profitability, dividend policy, and risk, because that really goes to the heart of the challenge that we have. I think in one of the slides that we showed, the prior measurement of capitalization in the business of Sasria was measured on a single factor, and that is a ratio of net written premium to capital, and that margin was 25%. And by that measurement, Sasria was deemed to have been solvent or had excess capital requirements from an FSB measurement perspective of about 575%, so a really big number. That basis has changed. What we are now approaching is a regime where we start to look at the 1 in 200 year event, and you look at the actual risk, and that really goes to the heart of what I had been trying to talk about earlier. The actual risk that Sadria runs in terms of the business that it has on its books, and what we're really trying to do is to say, in the worst case, if South Africa had a 9/11 type event, what would that cost be? And to try and quantify what the circumstances would be and so on. And so there are various scenarios around which this is looked at. Currently, and remember that this, we only take into account these factors on the basis of the risks that we insure, because there's some people that are buying, so it's not a compulsory purchase. What our current assessment is, actuarial assessment is, that we could have an event equivalent of about a 10 billion rand payout. And so therein lies a dilemma. There is a huge shortfall between what the actual capital reserves are and what the estimated reserves required are meant to be. We currently fund that as a management team. We currently fund that through the purchase of reinsurance. Now, put another way, and within the context of which this question was asked, that purchase is an additional cost to the South African taxpayer. So that's our money that we're using to buy for the sleep easy that in a 1 in 200 year event we might need to make up the shortfall. So the obligation on management going forward certainly has to be to bridge that gap. They've got to find ways in which to do it. And hence the point that I made that with the rise in attritional claims, normal claims, the march through the streets of Cape Town cost 5 million rand, or somebody sets a train alight because the train arrives late, or there's a in Pakhalsdorp or something, there's a service delivery process that costs ½ a million rand. But the accumulative cost of those kind of events is at really too high a level. It shouldn't be at the level of where it is. And the worrying thing about it is that risk seems to be climbing. That ratio seems to be getting closer and closer to the 30% ratio. And so that makes it difficult for us to reinvest. In the declaration of the dividend, there are two ways of looking at that. The one is that where we are taking money as premiums, which have been legitimately calculated on a particular basis, from the insuring public, from private citizens, they buy insurance as they would buy any other insurance. So there is no distinction here between Sansa as an insurance company and a Santam or a Mutual Federal, or there's no obligation on people to buy it, but when they do buy it, there is a cost to the risk. And I might add that other than most recently, when we first started looking at the risk-based capital model, where we'd realized that in fact we'd allowed Sansa premium to slide way too much, and we needed to recover from that, and that was about, 2 years ago now. The price of Sansa over the period has been allowed to drift away, and I mean on a private household policy now, it's about 14 cents in the south. It's about a 70% reduction in rates over that time, which now we're going to have to be doing something about, because if this new risk factor of social unrest starts to impact again, we need to be adjusting and making sure that premiums keep in touch. That also will challenge the policy of acting as a privatized insurance company that has an obligation to pay dividends to shareholders from the profits. and through that you reinvest some of the profits and pay some extra dividend to your shareholder. We might get to a stage where actually we need to say, well, we can't do that, and we need to bring some of that money back to rebuild our reserves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add what Aram said. In terms of the premium growth over a number of years, I mean, last year was a big year for us. I mean, we our premium growth as a percentage was 28%. And that wasn't because we've increased the rate, but that was mainly driven because of the World Cup, 2010 World Cup. This big event for a company like Sazra tends to generate, we generate more income because people, they fear that there might be a terrorist attack and that's why people buy cover. What we also did last year, which also contributed in the increase in premium, we introduced a new product. We added the 1 billion layer, which we've never had before. And the reason why we've done that, and we did an exercise before we introduced this product, people buying that 1 billion layer in the London market, and the rate that the London market was charging, I mean the Lloyd's, was almost 10 times than the Sazra rate. So we felt that we will be able to bring down the rate and that's why. So that new product also contributed about 40 million to our business. And the increase also is driven to us going to the brokers and going to the clients. And this is part of our strategy, brand awareness, just to encourage people to buy Sazra because Sazra is not compulsory. The other question was our risk projection. I think we feel that the trend is changing, so the risk is going up. But it's a different risk, it's not a political risk, it's a risk as a result of strikes and service delivery. So as a company, we need to make sure that we've got a good balance sheet. The other question was about inflation management. I think as a company, I mean, in terms of our premium, we haven't increased in the last 8 years. The premium rate has reduced by 70%. We've only increased the rate twice in the last 8 years. And that was mainly because we wanted to make sure that we are fully capitalized as a company. So in terms of the inflation, we don't increase the rate every year. The increase in premium that we are getting is not because we are increasing the rates, because we are just being proactive and encouraging the premium. The other question was about unclaimed money or declined claims. The unclaimed money, we don't have that situation. I mean, that normally happens in the bank because people buy Sazra for a risk, and as a short-term insurance company, the contract is only for 12 months. So when people pay premium, it's because of a certain risk.
Thank you. I guess that's the end on our side, honorable members. Don't have any follow-up questions. You know, just listening to your presentation, there are a number of lessons, not even lessons, but I think you are a good indicator and a barometer of what is happening generally in society. Because the area that you have targeted has much to do with general dissatisfaction of broader civil society. And I was just looking at your trend, 2005 or 2002 and 2000 and something. If we had time, I would have loved to ask questions. Why specifically at this point in time or this year did you have this kind of higher claims and so on and so forth? But I think it's a good barometer that government can also use to understand, you know, the challenges at the ground or on the ground. The other area that would want to engage with you at some point is the area of the social investment. Understanding that you have to make sure that at any given moment your asset base
is commensurate with the challenges that you could actually confront at any given moment. More so you're dealing with both natural and unnatural disasters that may unfold. You see, there are these areas of pension funds, insurances, in general, the financial sector, in terms of how do we contribute towards the challenges. Before we came here, we had a discussion about the fiscal framework. And one of the areas that we're beginning to focus on or to depict is that in terms of job creation, if it's a priority for all of us, I think wherever we are as companies, that element should actually come through in terms of how do you reinvest in the communities and so on and so forth. It might be that we didn't have time to go into that area for today, but I think it would be important to look into that so that we don't only choose soft lending for quick returns, as much as you have to make sure that you don't endanger the investment or the possibility of an exposure for your client or consumer. On that note, I think we should really welcome your presentation and the first interaction with the committee. We definitely would love to continue to have more engagement. Like I said in the previous presentation, that our interaction becomes more fruitful if we go beyond the annual report and strategic plan, because that's when we begin to really understand what is going on in every institution and our expectations, and therefore your expectations on how it could actually assist you. And thank you very much for coming. We are aware that we tried to hurry you up the last minute. Unfortunately, you fly FAA. Thank you.
Something extra, which is one of these presentations. There is no paper, and I really do need it to pass in my report because I can't open the PPTX document.
The technical stuff, she does the technical stuff. So is it the PPT, is that the format?
It's PowerPoint, but it's one of these new programs. I have my old version of Microsoft Focus doesn't open documents that is PPTX. Oh. It's the newer Vista type of windows, and I've flatly refused to say Microsoft more for
Microsoft Office 7.
Yeah. I've only got an old office. But I was wondering, you know, it's not a huge presentation, and you know, sometimes you can just print like three little slides on one page. If you don't mind printing it out for me, just one copy, and I can always bring it in.
How about I change it?
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, great. If you can change it, I'll be very grateful. Thank you so much. PC Finance.
No, I've got a
computer. It's such a ripple with my computer, you know, to force me to buy their programs. And they're very expensive. They really are. But I find I'm having more and more of a problem because more and more people are missing it. What's this? PC Finance.
Oh, no. We are still contacting.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. Okay.
No, I'm just taking what I was going to upload. Oh, that's
public works. No, they're in big trouble.
Wait a minute.
Running out of paper, so I didn't use it. So I'm going to do that. And you know, it's all tough to change, you know, and if the chairperson says, you know, they really shouldn't be wasting so much time fixing grammar. trying not to do that. Because I sort of automatically sort of think of the right things, you know, to write in the reports, and I thought, boy, you've come a long way.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's a... Oh, I was